You've applied to the Richmond Valley Council to have your workers camp on the drilling site at Bentley. Why have you done that?
Well, that's correct. We've made that application so that workers can live on site. It means they don't have to travel to and from work. Clearly, it means they don't have to cross picket lines if they happen to be there, but it also means we've got less road traffic as well. So it's a common sense thing to do.
So using part designed to thwart protesters who may well try to interrupt the operations there and make it difficult for workers to access the site?
Well, that's certainly part of the process, yes.
Do you have faith that the police will be able to prevent protest activity at Bentley if it oversteps the law?
Well, first of all, we have take no exception whatsoever to protest or people expressing a different view. All we ask is that people respect the law and our rights and the rights of the farm and the contractors we work with. And we are confident that the community overall will respect us as well and that the police won't have any problems in upholding the law.
How much will you have to pay workers to camp on the site? Is it going to be much more expensive for you than putting them up in hotels?
I doubt it's much different at all.
Is there an extra cost involved? I mean, there's no...
If there's any extra cost, it'll be marginal. It might be, in fact, cheaper.
What about the willingness of workers to camp on site? Is it something that you gather they may prefer rather than having to run that gauntlet of protesters, as you say?
Well, I think in general they'd be probably quite happy at the end of a 12-hour shift to be able to walk back to work rather than having to travel to a casino or somewhere else. But I'm sure they would prefer not to have to cross a picket line anyway.
How will you provide... toileting and cooking and that sort of thing, because there certainly wasn't approval granted for that at the campsite on the neighbouring property where the protesters have been granted approval to camp.
I will have to follow the council's requirements there in terms of all those amenities, and we'll have to follow the letter of the law in that sense. Look, that's not a problem to us. These are quite easy things to manage, but I think just looking at it, anyone would say this is a common sense approach to managing the job safely. We want those people, when they get to work, focused on the job so they operate safely and look after everyone involved.
At Glenugie, the police sent the tactical response group as well as local police to manage the situation. What police resources are you hoping will be assigned to Bentley?
Well, that's not a decision for us. We've obviously met with police and advised our plans and the timing and so forth, and the police are considering it, weighing up their overall needs. They've only got a limited budget and a limited number of people, so they've got to look after the enforce the law in the entire region, not just us. So that's basically a police decision.
Mm. Will you be employing security guards?
Oh, yes, we will be employing security guards.
Mm. Any idea how many at this stage?
No.
But it will be flexible depending on the situation?
Look, we're not expecting a big problem. If you look at the protests we've had in the past, there are a small group of people who are unruly, people that no one supports, people who make death threats, cause damage, people who don't respect the farmers' rights. We do not think that they represent the bulk of the community. And we know that there are a lot of the people in the community who are worried about coal seam gas, and quite frankly, how can you blame them when you see Gasland and you see all the misinformation that is about in the industry? People are worried. Some of those people might feel that they need to protest. We don't think they do. But most of the people in the community respect the law, respect the Grahams, the farmer, and recognise that we have rights too. And we have no doubt that they will respect the police if they're instructed to move or so forth.
You've been up here consulting with people directly. Hmm. What's the reaction you've received when you've spoken directly to people who have come to see you?
You get a complete range. You get those people who are really pleased that we're drilling a well because they want to get gas in the area, they want to have the energy, they want to have the jobs, they want income for farms, they're delighted. And typically our shareholders on that side. You get some other people on the other side who are dead against us, who some for ideological reasons, they don't like fossil fuels. You get other people who are against us because they are genuinely worried about water and they believe Gasland and the stories that are going around. And then you get a lot of people who are in the middle saying, I don't know who to believe. This can't all be right. Then you get other people too who feel that they moved to the area because they liked the rural nature of it and they don't want it to be industrialised. They'd rather be... produce gas somewhere else. So there's a whole range of different views, but a lot of it comes down to the opposition we're getting comes back to basically fear of the unknown. Very few people in this area of the world have ever seen an oil or a gas well before. It's not familiar to them. They didn't grow up with a father or brother or sister in the industry, it's new and it's quite usual for communities and individuals to be worried about change. So this is not surprising. In fact, you'd almost expect it. Yeah. When I left Vietnam, working for Premier Oil to join Anzon, sort of midway through 2011, Gasland had only been out for 6 months, and I didn't expect this to be a problem. I thought I was going to be coming here to look after engineering and technical commercial things, the things I've already always done. I don't think anyone anticipated the impact Gasland would have on community attitudes. And we recognise we've got a lot of work to do to share information with the community and, most importantly, to demonstrate by our acts that the industry is safe.
We saw earlier this week a report confirming that uranium and boron contaminated water at the Santos operation in the Pilliga. The leak dates back to the previous owner, Eastern Star Gas. You've said to us previously there hasn't been any proof of contamination of aquifers. Can you guarantee that there won't be any similar instances once Metgasco's operations are up and running here?
I'd say the chance of it is extremely small, but let's get back to that Santos Pilliga one. That's one of the challenges the industry faces in communicating. I'd have to say where we are at the moment is the story is an absolute beat-up, in the sense that if you look at the headlines in the Sydney Morning Herald and so forth, they give a fundamentally wrong understanding of what went on. And if you'll give me a few minutes, I'll tell you what I do know about the incident. And this is all in the Land this morning, information I've picked up from Santos. Santos took over the operation about 2 years ago, and the first thing they did was complete audit to understand and check that the facilities were all in good order. They found one particular pond which wasn't designed to the same standard as the newer ponds, and they made a decision to build a new one. But they also did a study to check that there weren't any leaks, and the study came up and said, doesn't look like there's any leaks, or if there is a leak, it's very small. To be extra certain, they then went and did some electrical conductivity tests, which suggested there might be a small leak. So they then drilled a number of bores around the actual pond itself to see if there was a leak, and they found a small leak, and that's what they reported. Now, the leak itself is down into some clays with some small sand in it, like a perched aquifer, a very small one. It's about a 30-metre square area, one at 10 metres and one at 30 metres. Now, the water itself doesn't contain uranium or metals, the original coal seam gas water. The uranium metals were leached out of the clay, so it's naturally occurring uranium and metals in the clay. It's not in the coal seam gas water. And the advice I've been given, if a farmer's dam was to leak, the farmer's water would also leach out the same uranium and metals. It's not unusual, it's to be expected. But the important part is the aquifer in the area is 65 metres deep, another 30 metres deep, and they've sampled that water and it's not contaminated. So Santos took all the right actions to make sure it's safe. The environmental impact is minimal, and that's why the EPA came out and said there's no environmental or health damage. So instead of understanding that here's the industry doing the job properly, checking that the industry, that its operations are safe and taking corrective action appropriately, it's been beaten up as coal seam gas contaminates water. It wasn't anything to do with the well. It was due to a poorly constructed pond, which the new operator Santos took corrective action with. So it's a very, very tiny incident. But back to the general issue about things never, ever happen. If you go to the airline industry and ask, will a plane never fall out of the air, no airline board is going to give you a guarantee for that. Look at the Malaysian airline example only a week ago. If you go to the local hospital and say, will no one ever go to hospital and not pick up some infection? No, they can't. What they can say is that they will apply all the appropriate standards and controls and make sure the risk of an infection or a plane falling out of the air or an aquifer being contaminated is very, very small. They'll take all the appropriate action and they'll do work to show that the risk is extraordinarily small, and if there is contamination in this particular case, that we can respond to it very quickly and make sure the effects are minimal. But there are no guarantees in life. And I'm very proud of our industry. I've been working in it for more than 35 years, and I think we make an enormous and positive impact on the community. And I think we do so by managing safety and health and environment very well. And we can either look at safety, health and environment from an individual item by looking at things like how we design wells, we can look at the quality of the gas, the procedures we take to identify risks and manage them. And each one of those can lead you to conclude that we're a safe and environmentally acceptable industry. But the other way of looking at it is to say, forget about the building blocks for making sure we're safe. Let's look at the overall performance. And I think about the fact that there are over 1 million oil and gas wells in the United States alone now producing. Not all the wells that have been drilled, just the wells that are producing now. That doesn't include the wells in Canada or Mexico, just 1 million wells in the United States. There are very, very few cases of contamination of water. And the one or two that are there, it's not clear that it was due to a well or some other factor. And one of the complicating problems in this is, and people forget, is the fact that oil and gas occur naturally. You expect to find them in water above aquifers, because that's where, or above where the oil and gas deposit is, because that's where they were generated. So part of the problem in opening a tap and having gas and water come out in the gas land, that's not unusual. That occurred before any wells were drilled in the area. And if you look at fractionation, you'll find lots of examples of wells or water bores having gas flow from them well before any well was drilled there. If you listen to the chief scientist in New South Wales, Professor Mary O'Kane, she'll tell you that 90% of the wells in the Great Artesian Basin in Australia have methane, 90% of them, some from very small concentrations, but up to large concentrations. So finding hydrocarbons in aquifers is quite normal.
On ABC North Coast, my guest in the studio is Peter Henderson, the Managing Director of Metgasco. The Rosella well is a conventional gas resource. In this area specifically, how does that differ from a resource where the gas is trapped in a coal seam?
There are quite a few differences. Perhaps the most important one is the fact that if you want to get gas to flow from a coal, you have to pump the water from the coal so the pressure is reduced and the gas will actually leave the face of the coal and flow to the surface. So you're forced to produce the salty water to the surface where you need to have a pond for it and you need to treat the water and dispose of it. And as the life of the field goes on, the amount of water that you have to pump from the coal reduces and the amount of gas increases. So early in the life of the field, you get the water production which you need to handle, and as you go towards the end of the life, you get more gas and less water. A conventional field is quite different. We're looking for gas that's not in the coal, not against the surface of a coal. It's actually in the pore space of the sandstone. And when you drill the well and you open up to flow it, the gas flows by itself. It doesn't produce any water. And in fact, if we produce water with the gas initially, it is not a discovery. It wouldn't be economic, because as soon as you start getting the water to flow, the well will die. It won't flow anymore. It's not economic.
So it's
completely the reverse. Coal seam gas wells, you need to produce the water first and the gas later. In the case of conventional wells, you don't want to have water, because if you have water, you really don't have a discovery, or not a commercial one.
Okay, and you don't need to fracture the sandstone in any way. If the gas is trapped in the sandstone, it flows, you said?
In conventional reservoirs, you don't necessarily need to frack the reservoir to get it to flow. Now, in this particular case, we are aiming at a reservoir called sandstone called the Ripley Road, and we're hoping that this is about 2,000 metres or so, and we're hoping when we drill into it, not only is it filled with gas, but the gas will flow from it at rates which are commercially attractive. Now, there's one outcome which says that the rock won't be as of good a quality, and the gas will flow, but at a low rate, a rate which is not economically attractive. If that is the case, we need to suspend the well, go and think about it, do some more engineering, look at more approvals, and decide, is there a way that we can drill the well in such a way that the gas rates will be high enough to make it economic? And one of those ways is to drill horizontal wells, and another way of doing it is to fracture the well too. But we don't know that at this stage. We are hoping this well will give us commercially attractive gas flow rates just from the Ripley Road by drilling a vertical well. But it is an exploration well. Until we drill it, we don't know that.
If the conventional gas supply is as rich as your estimates suggest, will you need to tap the coal seam gas in this region? Is it vast, this conventional gas supply that you're talking about?
The well we're drilling is called Rosella. It's the second well in a structure, which we call the Greater McKellar Field. It was discovered in 2009 with the Kingfisher well, and the Kingfisher well was at the south of the structure. The Rosella well is about 10 kilometres further north, higher up on the structure, and if it's one overall structure, then it's a very big field, and we'll be very excited about it, and it could be very significant for not only Metgasco and the Northern Rivers, but New South Wales. But until you drill the well and find that the sands are there as you expect them to be, until you find that they're filled with gas rather than water, and until you find that it will flow at economic rates, you don't really know. So speculating about how big it could be at the moment is difficult.
Do you need as many wells for a conventional gas deposit as you do for coal seam gas? One every square kilometre or so?
The answer is probably not, but it comes back to very much the quality of rock we find. If we find some rock with what we call very good permeability, in other words, the gas will flow at very, very high rates, then you will recover a lot more gas per well, and you can get more gas out of an individual well on a day. Under those circumstances, you need relatively few wells. On the other extreme, though, if you've got a rock which was very tight, i.e. it won't flow gas at a fast rate, you would need more wells, and you would need to have horizontal wells, and you might need fracking or some other form of stimulating the well to get more production. But the reason we're drilling the well now is to find that out. If we knew that, we wouldn't need to have an exploration well.
There was an article in The Age earlier this week that took aim at some in the gas industry for overinflating the employment benefits of the industry. One example is of Allen Consulting, whose modelling found that Santos CSG expansion in the northwest would generate 2,900 indirect jobs from just 200 jobs. And among that 2,900 was 570 public sector jobs. It also claimed to boost the state's economy by $470 million a year. You've said that the protest movement has propagated misinformation consistently. Isn't it incumbent upon everyone in the industry not to gild the lily, not to use hyperbole and to play a straight bat if the public is to be convinced about the merits and the safety of the industry?
I would agree with you 100%. At the moment, we're not talking. We've got a situation where we've got a valuable resource and need the gas, yet both sides are simply in conflict. And we need some leaders in the process to bring us together and get some common sense. But yes, we both need to avoid gilding the lily. I can't talk about the Santos and the Allen study. I don't know the background. You might argue we're as equally guilty. We did a study about 2 years ago which said if we get our full-scale development, the best possible outcome, that it would create X number of jobs. And I think there was a newspaper article said Metgasco worth $2 billion. Well, that is a possibility. That's one we'd love to have, but that's only one possibility and a lot of smaller cases in between there where we are now and there. So, yes, I quite agree with you. We need to get some more common sense into the debate.
We spoke briefly about the differences between the water that's produced. How much produced water will there be from a full-scale production at the Rosella gas resource there at Bentley? That's what you're tapping into. With a typical well into that conventional gas resource, how much water is produced and what is the nature of that water?
Well, again, virtually none.
Virtually none, because it's conventional.
And that's one of the reasons that we have suspended our coal seam gas operations but decided to continue with the conventional well. The other thing about a conventional well is that you can get the results and the answers relatively quickly. The process is quite simple. We drill a vertical well, and as we're drilling it, we run a series of steel pipes down the well, which we call conductors, and we put cement between them and behind them, so we've really isolated the well bore from the different rocks we're drilling through. As you're drilling down, you're sort of looking at the rocks which are cut up by the drill bit, and you're analysing whether it's coal, shale or sandstone and building up knowledge. But once you've drilled the well, you run some tools down the hole on a wire which allow you to measure rock properties. You can tell whether it's a sandstone, a shale, or a coal. You can find out its porosity and density. And you can also determine to a reasonable degree whether you've got gas, oil, or water. So after drilling the well and running these what we call logging tools, you've got a fairly good idea of what you've got. Now, at that stage, you might say, you've had enough, it's all water, there's no reason to keep going, and we fill the well with concrete, remove the wellhead, rehabilitate the area, and go away. However, if we do get an indication of gas at that stage from the logging, we still don't know exactly how well it will flow. We'll have some ideas from the quality of the logs in terms of the rock's porosity and density, etc., but we do need to flow it for a short period. So if we're successful, at the end of the program, we'll probably test the well for 12 hours or 24 hours by flaring gas from the well. And with a conventional well, you can measure the pressures and the flow rates, and based on that analysis, you can come to a fairly good idea about what sort of quality rock you're drilling into, and you can sometimes get an idea of how extensive the field is. But you can all do all that in the space of a few days of testing. In contrast, coal seam gas is quite a bit different. Again, you need to pump the water from the coal before the gas will start flowing, but in some cases you might need to pump the water for 6 months before you get any gas to flow, and you might find the rates or gas production rates will continue increasing for 2 or 3 years afterwards. So the time between drilling your well and getting the results for a conventional well is a whole lot better for us than a coal seam gas well.
If Bentley goes into production, how will you get the gas to market?
We've got a range of different ideas at the moment. In fact, we're quite excited about a new bit of technology, which is called micro-LNG. People talk about it as being a virtual pipeline. Because the problem with gas compared to oil is you can't easily just put it in a truck and transport it places as you can with oil. One way of getting your gas to the market is to put a pipeline in place. But to do that, you generally need to have a fairly big client or customer at the end to justify the cost of the pipeline. Now, we're quite happy to build a pipeline to Casino. We'd very much like to supply gas to Richmond Dairies and the Meatworks and support the new industrial park there. But that pipeline isn't the only way to do it, and it would be more difficult to get pipelines to Grafton and Lismore and Kyogle, unless, of course, we were giving retail customers gas as well. So the new technology, micro-LNG, is the same thing as they're doing in Gladstone. You simply take the gas and you refrigerate it. You bring it down to about minus 260 degrees. You convert it from a gas to a liquid. So you can then transport the gas in cylinders just like LPG. And we're hoping to get that gas in an LNG form to people who are currently using LPG and diesel. And we think that has tremendous advantages. To give you an idea, people like the dairies who are using LPG as a fuel are probably paying between $25 and $30 a gigajoule for the LPG. If they're using diesel, they're paying $45. Even with the very high gas prices we're expecting in the eastern coast, $10 is about as high as we're going to get for gas. So there's a huge incentive to get our gas to these customers and back out imported LPG and diesel. Gas is also cleaner, it's not imported, and it's a lot safer to handle. And the advantage of micro-LNG is the fact that we can service a very large area around Casino, and there's quite a big market for us, and it's a real positive thing for the Northern Rivers region.
So you've mentioned Richmond Dairies and people who are driving vehicles that use gas. Would the gas be able to be supplied directly, or do it have to go interstate and then come back, up to Queensland and back? Can you perhaps explain who the customers are in our region? Because not many households in our region have gas piped to it, unlike Sydney, Newcastle and Wollongong.
No, that's exactly right. We're not looking for a retail customers here at the moment, but the plan would be we'd have small micro-LNG facilities, small skids, one or two semi-trailers type size, which would collect gas from a number of wells. They would convert it from a gas to a liquid, so you've got the very high energy concentration. A truck would come in and pick up the cylinders, distribute the cylinders to businesses like the dairies in the same way as LPG is supplied, and back at LPG and diesel. And so we could serve any industrial customer, you know, probably in a 1,000-kilometre radius of Casino with this gas. But that's the fixed user. There's also a very exciting business in terms of transforming the road transport from using diesel and petrol to using gas. And in the United States, you see a very big business developing at the moment where big fleets are being converted from diesel to gas. It saves a lot of money and it's a cleaner burning fuel and reduces America's dependency on imported oil. So we think it's the way of the future, but the buzzword at the moment is a virtual pipeline. It's a means of getting your gas to the market without the pipeline.
How many tankers could we be talking about?
It depends purely on the size of the market, but it's not that many. You can get a fair bit of energy in one particular cylinder.
Okay. In a presentation you issued last week, you've said that the Greater MacKellar field would be commercialised as soon as possible if Rosella, the well at Bentley, is successful. What does that mean? What's the time frame? How many other wells would you need to be drilling in that time frame?
If Rosella is successful, which means we get a gas flow rate which is clearly commercially attractive, there'll be two things we'll try to do. The first one is to get gas from that particular well to customers like the dairy, and the dairy will get our first priority. And we'll do that either through a pipeline or through micro-LNG or even perhaps compressed natural gas, which is like micro-LNG in terms of concept, except you're compressing the gas rather than refrigerating it. So a high priority will be to get gas to the dairies. But We don't have approval to do that. Of course, our approvals now in an exploration phase are item by item. So every time we get some seismic, every time we drill a well, we have to go back to government and to get approval. We do not have approval to produce this well, gas from this well, and sell it. We would have to go through the normal DA process, environmental approvals, community consultation, and demonstrate to everybody that we're doing the right thing in terms of our plans to get the gas from Rosella to the dairy. Now, in theory, you could do that in 18 months, but let's say 2 years. It's quite an involved process. Things don't happen here quickly, and there's lots of things we need to go through. But in parallel with that, though, we'd be saying, good, we've got a gas field here. It could be a very big one, but exactly how big is it? And we've got seismic at the moment, which tells us roughly how big it is, but it doesn't remove all the uncertainties. I think we'd want to do some more aeromagnetic survey work. We'd want to shoot some more seismic. We'd probably want to drill two or three more wells just to get a better idea of how big the field is. Again, each one of those activities will require full environmental approvals and consultation with the communities we do it. And as we pick up that information, we'd be then putting together a development plan for the field, which would show how many wells we will need to drill, and where the wells will need to be, who's going to be affected, if there's a compressor station where it needs to be, if there's a pipeline where it needs to be. We'd have to lay the whole thing out and go through the approval process. Now, I put in the handout for the Rosella well that it might take us 4 years. Now, that's, I think, the best that could possibly be achieved. That is moving very, very quickly. So it's quite a long time between getting a success and getting to the stage where we've got a reasonable scale commercial production.
Your coal seam gas activities are on hold because the political climate is not conducive at the moment. I think you've stated that, and that you'd like to proceed with that as soon as things change. The issue of water is one that hadn't been solved by the industry in terms of what was going to be done with all of the produced water. Can you explain where the latest thinking is at in terms of where that produced water is used and what treatment it needs to go through before it can be reused?
Yeah, perhaps the best way to explain that is that I'll give you what I learned from a conference I chaired in Brisbane last year on water handling. And it was really impressive. We had Professor Steve Raines, one of the water commissioners in Queensland, Land and Water Commissions in Queensland, get up and open the presentation. And he highlighted how the whole attitude in the industry had changed. 5 years ago, water was regarded as a waste product. Now it's valued as a very valuable commodity. And for the rest of the day, I was really impressed with just how much technology has been thrown at water management in general, from understanding the aquifers in the Great Artesian Basin to understanding how to process it and get the best outcome. And there's lots of different uses for the water in Queensland. Some of the operators are injecting the water into an aquifer. Some of it can be reused later on. Some of them are processing the water and using it for irrigation. And in one of the places, they're using the water for potable uses. They've got approval to do that. So there's a whole range of uses for the water in Queensland, and it's a highly valued commodity at the moment.
What are they using? Reverse osmosis technology to?
There's a range of doing that. Reverse osmosis is one of the technologies to use, but it depends very much on the water itself, what the qualities of the water are, how much salt there is in it, and what the end user wants. I mean, the controls and things put in place for this are very, very strong. If you look at where we operate, we are fortunate in the fact that our wells don't produce as much water as some of the wells in Queensland. Our water also isn't very salty. It's about 1/10 of the salinity of seawater. We've done extensive testing on it. The only reason that you couldn't use it really for potable water is the fact it's salty. We're not proposing to use it for drinking water, just the same. We've done extensive ecotoxicity testing on it, which confirms it's not toxic. I've drunk the water just to demonstrate that I'm confident in it. And recently, we've got approval from the New South Wales government for the water we produced in our ponds to be used for stock purposes in the local area. So we went through the full analysis of the data, the ecotoxicity testing. We got veterinarian studies done to show that it was suitable for the cattle. And so we've established that's a good way of using it. But I don't see we'll have any problems in handling water in the future.
Does it need to be treated for the salt, even if it is a low concentration?
No. Sometimes we will need to take the salt out for the particular use, so we don't need to remove the salt because the salt levels are so low, the water is of acceptable quality.